I don't think kids have an attention span gap. The style, perhaps, of some of the stuff they're watching has changed and evolved, and it does with every generation. Blue Peter is proudly the longest running kids' TV series in the world, and what we want to do is keep that always relevant.
It's not finding the right people, it's finding people from all different types of diversity and different socioeconomic backgrounds. Manchester is just growing so quickly.
What I see in portfolios and showreels is students who are combining together skills that students 10, 15 years ago weren't doing. That's one of the mindsets that I look out for in people that I want to give opportunities to. That non-linear thinking is where the new stuff is going to come from, essentially.
You're listening to Foundations, recorded live from Campfield, Manchester. Foundations is a celebration of bold beginnings, brave ideas, and the people who make them possible. In this episode, head of Versus Studios, Edward Harvey, and guests discuss shaping St. John's through media and entertainment.
So, welcome to Campfield Studios. This is day one of the life of Campfield Studios. We've been going through a long process in terms of the redevelopment. It's been very exciting, and we are looking forward to a future at Campfield Studios with various events, television production, content production, and generally collaborating with producers and media creators in Manchester and in the UK. I'd like to welcome to our first panel in the studios. We've got Paul Austin from Picture Shop. We've got Ellen Evans from Blue Peter.
Thank you.
And we have Nathan Newman from Immersive Science. What we'd like to have a chat through today, and it's going to be quite sort of open conversation, but essentially we've been talking, and we've been talking to broadcasters as well, more and more about the changing consumption of content and how audiences themselves are consuming content in a different way, and that therefore we have to look at how we produce content in a different way to react to that and to be proactive to it too. Also, there is a push, there's always been a push to encourage young talent into production as well. And I think with the changing ways that people are consuming content, actually younger members of the audience basically should have a voice in that content creation because they've got more reference to that. So it's a case of not only bringing youngsters into the industry, but it's also involving them in the creative process much earlier on than they would normally be in a traditional sort of come in, join a production company, and it takes you normally quite some time to actually move through that production company's sort of process. And also looking at new technology. We've all been involved in looking at new technology and actually how do we apply that new technology to create those new pieces of content, and also how do we use that technology to inform us about how the audiences are reacting to how we're producing producing content and whether it's the right way of doing it. So I sort of, Paul, as you're first on to my left, what are your thoughts?
First of all, I've got four children of varying ages. So, yeah, I definitely noticed that the content consumption is very different from mine when I was their age. Getting them to watch a TV show is difficult. If they do watch that TV show, they're always second screening. They're practically living on TikTok. They live on YouTube. But from our business perspective, I'm MD at Picture Shop Manchester, just down the road at the ABC building. We do traditionally long form broadcast work in terms of scripted, unscripted animation work. We do a lot of short form work in terms of a lot of commercials and a lot of trailer work. We do all the trails for the BBC. For us, it's whatever the content requirement is, we need to adapt the business and make sure we're being flexible so that our core skills and delivery is meeting what the clients need. As it stands, we're not noticing major differences yet in terms of some of the deliverables we're having to change in terms of making it shorter and different formats. But that long form work is still in place. In terms of the industry, obviously, we keep an eye on the industry as a whole. Quibi, which was introduced in 2020, which was a Netflix-type streamer, which was aimed specifically at high-end episodic content for but only on short form basis and often being longer than 5 minutes, trying to target that market. That was Jerry Katzenberger from Disney who set that up. I think he invested over $1 billion in it, but unfortunately he launched it at the time of COVID and it didn't quite catch on. But in terms of things like micro dramas and micro content, it's growing massively. It's the biggest growing part of the industry now, especially in Asia. I did some research and the industry over in China alone was 5.6 billion last year. And when I say a micro drama, these are the things you see when you are flicking through TikTok right. or Facebook or wherever, where they'll hook you in and it's 1 or 2 minutes of content and you want to see the rest of the content and then you'll get another app. But then if you want to download the whole series, you have to go onto the app. Yeah. And then you subscribe.
But it's pulling you into the longer form, isn't it? So
yes, but there isn't a longer form in there. There right. is. It is literally 100 episodes of about 1 to 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And you pay per episode as you okay. go through. Like say in China, it was about, globally, it was about 2.4 million. In China alone, it was 5.8 million last year.
Wow.
And I think that will definitely, like TikTok had, yeah. will spread to the West, definitely. And I can see that going. But from our perspective, again, that's yeah. it's a format issue rather than a content issue. Yeah. I think people just, they're living how they live and how they want to consume the media has changed, yeah. but there's still a demand for high quality, high-end yeah. production.
But it may well be a situation where you're doing faster turnaround edits, so you're not getting into that long-form piece, but you're actually, you know, you've got younger guys, yeah. you know, younger people within your team potentially getting into that edit process yeah. and actually producing that sort yeah. of stuff.
But what we're noticing is with the younger audiences that they want that short form content. Mm. They want that instant sort of fix. But they do also then want the long form stuff. Like my daughter at the moment is already obsessed with Love Island. They're watching a lot of reality shows. They're watching a lot of true crime shows. And they want to watch the high end dramas as well. But it's that bit in the middle, that yeah. sort of lower budget, you know, when you're going through your TV box and there is just hundreds of channels, that they don't even flick now.
And it's a mix, isn't it? You can be consuming the long form and the short form. It's actually part and part. And you sort of mentioned about watching on multiple, you know, screens. Yeah. My son's the same. So you could actually be watching some of those short forms along with the long form. Yeah. yeah. Ellen.
Hello.
Hello. So how do you, I know that you're, we're just about to welcome you to our new studios. So it's great news for us. We've been working with Ellen's team for, well, quite some time now. It's probably about sort of 12, 18 months, talking about how Versa can support Ellen and his team in terms of a creation solution in Manchester. I think the initial conversations were really about how we can support, not the main show in terms of providing locations, because we've got all the locations here. We've got Strange Studios, which can provide much different backdrops, etc. But as the conversation moved on, it sort of reached a point where we thought that we could create a new home for you.
Yeah. Going back to your point earlier as well about the way kids are consuming content and how that's changed. We've spoke about this, Edward, as well. I don't think kids have an attention span gap or anything like that. I think, like you said, Paul, kids are watching loads of stuff, loads of the time. But actually, the style, perhaps, of some of the stuff they're watching has changed and evolved, and it does with every generation. This isn't something new, but there has been a huge generational shift. And it's been really well documented in, like, research that the generational shift is the trend in the all the audiences is away from sort of watching linear broadcast channels towards watching stuff on demand anywhere, anytime you want. And actually that generational shift is most pronounced in the kids. So actually our audience is moving quicker than the other audiences. And so maybe we have to be moving to catch up with that. Otherwise we're going to become a legacy and we don't want to do that. You know, like Blue Peter is proudly the longest running kids TV series in the world. And what we want to do is keep that always relevant to the current generation and what they're most excited and interested in. So I think with the process of thinking about how we take Blue Peter forward into the future, we have got this focus on Absolutely. If you want to sit down and watch us on telly at 5 o'clock, we're there for you. Don't worry.
You can't get rid of that, can you? No. I mean, that's a bedrock of
exactly. And, you know,
the schedule.
So Blue Peter's still going to be on CBBC, the Blue Peter Children's Channel for kids age 7+. We're also repeated on BBC Two when we're in the Science Zone as well for the deaf community. And that will stay the same. But what we really want to do is, you know, focus on that audience who are watching on demand on iPlayer and making sure that what they get there is something that's going to keep them wanting coming back for more. We've always tried to feel really connected with our audience. Like, everybody's heard of a Blue Peter badge, I hope. But thousands of kids still write to Blue Peter every week to tell us what they're into, to tell us what they love, and tell us what they want featured on the show. And we have this dialogue with them where we, like, send a letter back and say, well done, thanks for sending your idea or poem or picture. You know, we celebrate that on the show and send it back to them.
That's a really special connection with your audience. I mean, there aren't many, you know, I'm trying to think. Yeah. Melvin Bragg from years ago, he used to actually write to all of the people that who used to write into him. And because we used to dig out, I used to work in the archive, and actually you used to dig out all of his letters, and they were photocopied. And he went, my goodness, he actually wrote to them. But you're doing that, and you're still doing that.
So it's
which
a very
special.
Sort of, what I love about Blue Peter is it's a sort of mix of the old and the new. What you want to do is keep it new and relevant for this current generation, but not let go of the things that keep it really special from the past. So for me, it's always been about rejuvenating the show, making it exciting for current audiences, but really keeping the heart of the show the same and the sort of values of the show and the tone of the show the same, you know, which is really sort of encouraging and inspirational and a little bit educational, very fun. So you still find like adventures and challenges and crafty makes and things like that. But actually, maybe when they're packaged in, you know, we are thinking much more about the show in terms of a magazine show. When you think about it, a daytime magazine show might feel like a very old-fashioned format. It's been going since the days a broadcast began. But actually, if you think about the show as five bits of short form together as a sort of compilation of, you don't know what's coming next, some things you love, some things you don't know you love yet, but you might find something you didn't know about and that might be quite exciting. Actually, I think that translates really well onto the different digital platforms that kids are accessing content through. So,
and I suppose there's a point where, with your previous live show, to cut that up would into bite-sized pieces is quite hard because you're live and it's running like a live show.
I think the difference is almost what's happened quite a lot in broadcast environments is you make a show for telly and then you cut it up for short form, and it's almost like retrofitting digital. We've talked about this a lot as a team. So we're trying to think about, how does this work as a self-contained piece? And it's interesting actually when you talk about short form, because you know, a lot of the short form on digital platforms is less than a minute, and actually there are lots of kids watching on things like YouTube Kids, and they're watching hours of stuff. Hours. Actually, YouTube is a platform that does support longer form content too.
I don't. It's not that thing where we're transgressing into short form, everything short form. It's just, it's got to be part and parcel of the consumption of what's available to those viewers.
Sort of flipping it on its head a little bit.
Nathan.
Hello.
What are your thoughts on, in terms of production and getting into the new technology and how you're finding and how you're applying that new technology to actually enhance the creative piece in terms of producing new content?
Yeah, so a big part of my background's been shared across media marketing and tech. And I started off many years ago, 20 years ago, in the video games industry, and what's happened more recently in the last 5 or 6 years or so is that real-time technology has started to tip over into moving image production, where game engines are being used to, you know, make content essentially, together with LED screen technology. So over the years, what I've been looking at is a mixture of how the IP development process can be amplified or improved with these types of tools. So how can you make short form content that can be used to test audiences or to get market validation on new concepts, all the way through to what are the creative opportunities around sharing assets that are created to be used as virtual sets and virtual production that can be then used in other mediums and other formats and in other ways. So essentially, how can you get more mileage out of the content that you create for these virtual production pipelines? And we've seen a lot of early stage development work with virtual production leading to commissions and to conversations that ordinarily wouldn't happen because the route to creating a prototype or a proof of concept of an original IP or maybe a new IP based on a pre-existing concept is a little bit faster to put together, but also it helps to show decision makers what's possible so that they can better imagine what that content's going to be, which audience it's going to fit, and how they'd like to back it.
That's a very powerful tool, isn't it? Because when we're normally pitching program ideas to commissioners, there's often quite this gap between something written on a piece of paper to actually what's it really going to look like. And everybody in the create, or a lot of people within the creative industry, actually need to see something to be able to understand it and then therefore commission it. And so the set's not built yet, you've made a model. There's a script there, yeah, that's fine, but actually what's the interaction going to be? And we've made various sort of pilot dummy walkthroughs in a village hall sort of thing, but that's still quite hard for people to imagine because it's just the dynamics of, let's say, a quiz show. But what you're able to do is actually create a really high value level image production, which then can be taken to the commissioners.
Yeah, that's right. And there's we're really just at the beginning of what that means for virtual production, and producers are starting to learn more and more that you can create really polished, almost near final proof of concepts that are short form for a fraction of the budget, and then you can collect data with those bits of content, with those assets. But essentially, virtual production is a redistribution of some of the creative processes and thinking. So one thing that I've probably become quite known for seeing in the Manchester area is that virtual production is about fix it in pre-production.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is there has been this fix it in post mentality traditionally in our industry with some things. And with virtual production, you have to preload a lot of your decision making in the pre-production phase, so that you don't have a situation where you do have to fix it in post, because it's a little bit difficult to do that. But the advantage is that you are able to get your team, your heads of department, all on the same page and gather around the same problems and think about them at the same time, rather than have creative decisions and the trickle-down effect of decisions going in perhaps a way that might create problems versus a way that might be more conducive to good results. And bringing those complications right towards the beginning of the process. And what I've also found is that with that redistribution of thinking and strategic modalities, if you will, on how to create production strategies, it then naturally trickles down into thinking about what kind of marketing content is going to be created and what the other creative opportunities are around producing a show.
So that visualization then for every element of commissioner, marketing teams, future series, and also that edit process as well, because if the commissioners and the producers are seeing that content earlier, they're being offered the opportunity to think up of more ideas rather than classic ideas on the day where it's like, well, can't we do this? And it's like, well, we're actually in studio. We've got the talent here. This is quite hard now to change this. That's a really valuable thing to do. And we've all been in situations where we've gone into the edit and people said, actually, this wasn't what I imagined the show was going to be like. And it's like, well, what did you think it was going to be like?
Yeah, and that's a really big problem just in general across media entertainment. And when I worked more exclusively in video games, it was the same issue. In the sense that you have the product team and then you have the marketing team, and there's this gap between those two teams. And sometimes surprises come out of the woodwork a little bit too late in the process. So what's interesting about working with VP to create proof of concept as a way of collecting data is that data can help improve predictive analytics on the success of a show. Mm-hmm. Because it can take that content, put it out to a test audience, maybe publish it to social media, collect data, and that data can create a feedback loop into the development process.
Yeah.
So you can almost do software-like iterative development sprints in the development process rather than traditional development being about a script and a treatment and maybe some concept images.
Yeah. Because Ellen, you found, obviously, we were talking the other day about the data feedback that you're getting and how that's, you know, it's influencing and it's yeah. helping you with your creative decisions.
Yeah. One thing I'd say about how we work as a production team is every week we talk about the show and we review it together as a team and we kind of give constructive feedback in a safe environment and everything. But one thing we also look at is the data. And when you are working on digital platforms, you can have a much more rich seam of data than you would have had traditionally as a broadcaster, you know, where it's a very sort of, it's a number on a piece of paper,
yeah.
but you don't know where, you know, people are from or what they're watching or how old they are or anything like that. So actually now, if you are, you know, on digital platforms like BBC iPlayer, you can get much more rich, deep data. And obviously, if you're working on platforms like YouTube, you can get really granular detail on your audience and what they're liking. And almost even look at aspects of your video and where people switch off, which is a bit brutal, but it's telling, you know, and it's sort of, it's really useful to be able to see that. But I think our creative process is almost like constant evolution, like constant iteration, constant, like, how do we build upon that? If it was good, what would we do differently if it wasn't as we intended? And I think a lot of good, supportive, creative teams should be like that, I hope, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. We were running a podcast event yesterday, in fact, with Pact and Audio UK, and they're totally focused on podcast creation. But it was really interesting talking to them and how, again, it's short form podcasting. But one of the people who were on the panel, they actually do podcasting, but they're not one entity podcast. They're literally every day. And they said that the data that they're getting back from that is really, really mind-blowing because it's going online, because it's streaming.
It's also quite powerful when you're having conversations with decision makers as well, you know, because you can have this great idea and you can go, well, why should we do that? And actually, if you can back it up with the data, that's useful. And also in a really old-fashioned way, I do want to hark back to this, but we have a database of like 300,000 kids who currently have a blue Peter badge. And, you know, when the team talk to us about an idea, they might come in and say, let's do a film about gymnastics, or let's do a film about this, that and the other. And you can actually look on the database and go, how many kids have written about gymnastics? And you go, oh great, it's really popular. You know, so you can use, we have lots of different weird data sets that you can draw on. It's really
so you're picking, you're starting to sort of go, actually we've got those other subjects that we should pick up on.
You know, when we were working with someone recently who was talking to us about YouTube, he was like, it's great to do audience research, but that's a really small sample in a room, that sort of in-depth qualitative research. But actually, if you have millions of data sets telling you where the audience is and what they're liking about what you're doing and what they're not liking that you're doing, it can be quite powerful to help you sort of steer the direction. But you always keep it true to your brand. You don't want to try and be somebody else because that's popular, because that's not going to work either.
Well, maybe that's that thing that you're getting millions of viewers feedback, so it stops becoming a case study of like 100 people, which can skew actually what's, and so it could affect your creativity almost too much.
Yeah. You know, like you might do a bit of qualitative research in a classroom, and actually that is quite powerful sometimes to watch a show with kids in the room, because then you can literally see, you know, the bits where they start to fidget and you go, oh, that wasn't very good. But actually at the same time, I lost my train of thought there.
So there's a huge value in being in the classroom. Yeah. However,
but then, like, say one kid goes, "Oh, I think, you know, your section on books is boring." That's one kid's view, and actually, there could be other kids who love that. You know, so I think I'm agreeing with you, Edward, that you sort of the wider the data set, the more rich that is.
And not for the BBC because they're a PSB, but in terms of, you know, your commercial entities, there's real commercial value in that data in terms of so many production companies now are looking towards branded content, towards branded shows, whether that's short form or long form. And if you've got that data in terms of the interactivity and the people that you're actually targeting, and they can use that for, you know, commercialization later on, it's gold dust.
It is. And we were talking yesterday, I mean, let's be honest, you know, financially, you know, the industry is, as ever, you know, it's hard to raise money to get an idea underway and that sort of thing. And this data is exactly as you're saying, this data supports, what is this show going to work? How have you created it? Because you can sit there with an initial fantastic idea. We've all had fantastic ideas, but actually it takes a lot more creation to turn a fantastic idea into something that is impactful for your audience. You might love the idea, but actually we're all about engaging with a wide audience, because we're in commercial television after all, and you want it to work. And so that, again, yesterday was very much about every single show that goes out now on streaming. There's a whole ton of feedback about that, which is valuable going forward, as well as proving the value worth. Yeah, cool.
And on Nathan's point, I'm more than happy for to be fixed in production and not fixed in post. That'd be good. And I would just say, I have got a Blue Peter badge, which is my proudest of possessions.
Yeah. We got to dive into this now, Paul.
I used to work on Blue Peter many years ago when it was in London at TV Centre, and it was the 50th anniversary, and I got a gold badge.
Got a gold badge?
I got a 50-year gold badge.
Is this your mic drop moment, and you're just going to walk away and say thanks very much?
That's not the gold badge, though.
It's not the gold badge.
It's the 50th birthday gold badge.
I mean, we've been together now. We've been chatting for 3 years in Manchester, and actually, you've come to the new home of Blue Peter. I mean, this is perfect how you've done that. Thank you for keeping that.
I'll bring it in for you.
Listen, I'm very pleased that you've held that on until this special moment. So that's a big moment in our podcast history. Just moving on in terms of young talent as well. It's something I'm particularly getting involved and passionate about, and connecting with the young talent, particularly in Manchester, because we're based in Manchester. And we've started working with Salford University, and they've got 2 or 3 film, television, creative design courses, and trying to engage with those talented people. But also the difficulties, because I know what it's like walking into an industry like this. It's pretty scary walking into a TV studio and just phoning somebody up. You know, who do I connect with? There's something that we need to do to soften that connection from your university or creative position where you want to get into the industry. Well, how do you make that happen? I've been working with them. How do you engage with and bring new talent through into the post-production business?
It's crucial in terms of, we're a talent industry and you need those rising stars. It's not finding the right people, it's finding people from all different types of diversity and different socioeconomic backgrounds as well, which is hard because it's quite a specific niche part of the industry in terms of post-production. So we work really closely with Salford Uni as well, and we feed into their curriculum and we do a lot of masterclasses and workshops with them. We work with the Manchester Film School, we work with Belton University, who are very good in terms of their VFX courses. But they're people who know about the industry and have gone through that route and are, you know, applying, and we will always bring them through. It's also trying to find ways where you're getting people who don't know about what those roles are, because there's a lot of people, like we've talked about already, who are, you know, they're making content and putting it on YouTube or putting it on TikTok, but just don't understand about that sort of more traditional long form potential roles for them. We work in partnership with Screen Manchester. They're doing amazing work at the moment as part of the Northern Screen Alliance. It's Screen Manchester, the Liverpool Film Office, the North East Screen Film Office, and Screen Yorkshire. And it's BFI funded with National Lottery money, and they are aiming at the local colleges and advertising roles for people who haven't gone through those degrees but have got an interest in the media sector. They co-fund placements, and it's a rotating 5-week placement that we've had. We've been working with them for 18 months now. It's gone brilliantly. We've given 3 of them permanent roles now, and they're part of the team, and they're going to have great careers. So it's things like that. In terms of partnership, we work very closely with Morning Live, who are in our building. Yep. So that's a live studio gallery environment, and we do all of the VTs for them for their edits. we've worked with them to create an editor trainee scheme. So the juniors come in through our place, then they'll go in through Morning Live, and then they become freelance editors and then go out into the market and work.
And of course, they're based in Manchester, living in Manchester. And that's a really powerful thing. And actually, you know, we sort of campaign for how creative and strong the industry is in Manchester and how it can grow further. You know, we're bringing studios back to life, which is a fantastic step. There are more things that we can be doing as well. But what you're doing there is you're tapping into the local community. You're bringing that passion into your business, but we're growing it in Manchester.
And it's not just Manchester, because Screen Manchester, though it is Screen Manchester, have a, it's called the Connected Campus, which they're doing with all of the different screen
yes.
companies. And so, like, we've had Oldham College in, we've had yep. Warrington College in, we've had people coming in from near enough every sort of sixth form and yep. Further Education College around the area outside Manchester as well. And these are people who generally don't even know what the no. role is or what we do or how we do. And it's just to give them an introduction for it. And then they can then apply for that placement scheme through Screen Manchester.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because when you get into the industry, you actually don't, you think you know what the industry is about and what's going on, but actually you don't. I think, I mean, everyone that I know has stepped into it and suddenly go, oh goodness me, I didn't know that was there. And people can have a preconception of what they're aiming to do. And I always sort of say, keep your mind open, because you'll trip over something. Talk to everybody, because everyone in the industry is happy to talk and share their experiences. But you'll trip over something. You'll suddenly think, I didn't see that at university. I didn't come across that, but I absolutely love it. And it turns into maybe a career.
And I don't want to sound negative or cynical, but no. A lot of people pay lip service to it. And a lot of people say they're doing things, but you don't actually see it turn into anything. They'll think they're ticking a box and they're doing this, but you don't see end results. People aren't actually coming into the industry. And Manchester is just growing so quickly. And there aren't talent gaps here now, but when we opened up 7 years ago, there were certain talent gaps in certain areas, and we needed to bridge them quickly, which we have done now, to the point where, you know, our London clients come up here, and then, you know, they're not paying for anyone to come up from London now. They trust the crew and the creatives up here, but that's taking
time.
That's
a big story. You've filled the gap. It's now connected.
But what we're having to do then is just make sure that next generation yep. are coming through and that doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Nathan, from a point of view of bringing new talent in, and particularly with the new technologies that you're applying in such a creative way, I know you've got a relatively young team as well and their experience, but how you look at that side of the business? And
well, it's a good kind of scary in a way, because a lot of students or people who are self-taught have got the benefit of a lot of tools that can assist their creativity. So as an example, 20 years ago, if you wanted to learn 3D modeling, YouTube wasn't around, but also generative AI wasn't around. So you couldn't use a tool like AI as a way of soundboarding different ideas that rely on different skills from different industries to try and create a thing that you've got some big idea around. And I think that level of convergence that's happening, where students don't care as much about the knowledge silos that are around the differences between different skill sets, and just see it as this combination of skills that are interesting to them, rather than being skills that are siloed in very specific ways, is quite interesting. So a lot of what I see in portfolios and showreels is generally students who are combining together skills that ordinarily students maybe 10, 15 years ago weren't doing, to create new things and to invent new things in new ways. And I think that's really quite exciting. And that's one of the mindsets that I kind of look out for in people that I want to, you know, work with and give opportunities to and encourage, because that nonlinear thinking is where the new stuff is going to come from, essentially.
Yeah, and there's a certain level of technology that is available. You know, if you've got a laptop and you've got a DSLR camera, you've got the tools to make a TV show and at high quality. And so that's really exciting for them to be able to achieve that. I mean, we were at Salford the other day, and the third year student Grace had created this animated piece, which was about a minute and a half long. But she'd built the model, she'd to design the whole setup. It's stop motion. It was funny and it was dark. So she'd worked on the script. She created the script. She worked with her colleagues to do the lighting and she filmed it. And in one, and then of course I turn around and sort of say, so how long is it? I mean, one, this is absolutely amazing and it's funny and it's dark. How brilliant. How long did it take? And she said, oh, you know, 3 to 4 weeks whilst she's doing the rest of her studies. And it's like, wow. And also the textual, you know, she'd created all of the clothing that was on the doll. And it was like, it was stunning. But also with the technology as it was, you know, the clarity of the picture was phenomenal. And we need to embrace that, don't we? And we're working to try to get her work out and sort of, we've connected, haven't we, Grace, with you? And you don't know where it's going to go, but without connections, it's going to go nowhere. And that's the thing. I think we've just got to keep making more connections and meeting people and then letting them meet us. Because we don't know. We've all started somewhere.
Yeah, there's an element of the future where TV shows are going to be made in game engines and video games are going to be made with cine cameras. And there's all these weird formats and the hybrid bits of content which are emerging in different ways through different quarters of industry. And I think those are the really exciting things to keep an eye out for, really. It's trying to find what's different.
Yeah. Anna?
I completely agree with you, actually, that often people are very multi-skilled now in the industry. You know, you are looking for people on your team that can, to a certain extent, self-op edit, to do sync pulls, who can shoot stuff, who can direct stuff, who can tell a story, you know, who can cast great kids, who, you know, everything. So, even like create simple graphics and things. And I think one thing I love, we're working with Screen Skills as well and like local colleges like you are. But I did want to shout out the BBC Apprentice Scheme because that's probably a little bit different from the other people on the panel. There's a website called Get In and it's the early years careers at the BBC. And there's lots of different opportunities in sort of tech and in production and really brilliant people come up through that. And actually on our team like yours, you know, there's at least 3 or 4 members of our team who have been the apprentices and come up through and just been fantastic and, you know, have amazing careers in the industry. So that's one thing I wanted to add. People who are looking for opportunities.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, we've all got plans and actions that we're doing to actually bring young talent through. And as we were talking when we first started talking about it, is as production changes, as consumption changes, we have to have those the young talent coming through. And we're trying to fill the gap from historically with BBC and ITV sort of drifting away from their staff bases, which they had. And we remember the times when BBC Centre, ITV in London and Granada up here had their staff bases. And you know, you would join as a youngster, like I did at the age of 21, and you'd be meeting people from all sorts of different genres, makeup artists, producers, directors, script writers, all those sorts of people all within the bar. And you would be able to interact with them. And now interaction for young talent is so much harder. So actually, it's kind of our job to fill that void and create those places where people can come, interact, and we can look at their work.
It's really interesting, actually, that point, because I think that we are a much more freelance industry, and that can be quite lonely and can make you feel quite anxious at times as well. So it'd be a really interesting challenge, I suppose, to do the sort of social things. And I know, you know, they do events for like young people coming through. But I do sort of say to people as well, like networking isn't like a mad mystery. It's actually just the people that you work with who are really sound and you do a good job and they do a good job. So you call each other up to work again together. You know, it's not necessarily going to a cocktail party.
Yeah, networking's got that old school. You're absolutely right. Networking's got that old school. Oh, network, and it's a bit weird. And it's like some people like networking and some people don't. Yeah. It's like, it's actually called meeting people and having a good time. I actually went to an event which I was presenting at, which was meeting hoteliers. And I got asked to do a presentation at a hoteliers event. And I'm like, I've got to say, I was like, what on earth am I going to do? What am I doing here? But, you know, hell, we'll go along. And I went along and I met some fascinating people. I found out some of the things that are going on in Manchester that I didn't know about. I also found out the reason why they're interested in finding out about what we're getting up to, because the more shows we bring into Manchester, have got audiences and that sort of thing, the more hotel rooms are going to be full. And so we're part and parcel of the ecosystem. And it's kind of like, oh, yeah, of course we are. Because, you become obsessed with your own industry and what we're trying to do, and we're so busy. But actually, we are indeed part of an ecosystem in Manchester, the region, and across the UK. So actually, whatever the networking is, whoever you're meeting, something can come out of it that could be really interesting. So that's cool. And thank you very much. I think that's about it. May I thank Nathan, Ellen and Paul for being part and parcel.
Thanks, Edward.
Thank you.
Thank you for being part of our parcel of our chat. I hope it's been interesting, and a good welcome to Campfield Studios.
You've been listening to Foundations, a celebration of bold beginnings, brave ideas and the people who make them possible. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts for the latest episodes, and follow @CampfieldMCR on Instagram.